and those sponsors. Next up for presenters from DNR again, we have Helen Berry. Helen is a marine ecologist at DNR's Nearshore Habitat Program. And she's gonna keep us in the marine vegetation realm here, talking about kelp, but she's done long-term monitoring of nearshore vegetation and intertidal communities. And she'll be joined by Max Calloway. Max is a master's student at the Evergreen State College, focusing on the health and distribution of South Sound bull kelp populations. He's also a kelp biologist with the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, where his work focuses on the ecology, conservation, and restoration of Puget Sound kelp bed canopies. So welcome, Helen and Max.
Hi. In the last talk, you heard about eelgrass, and I'm going to talk about another ecologically important nearshore vegetation type, which is kelp. Kelp provides many of the similar ecosystem services as eelgrass, and they're also really fun places. Kelp beds are fun places to visit, and you can see that, like, you'll find kayakers and divers and photographers and all sorts of other people around them. They teem with life. This presentation explores kelp distribution in South Puget Sound, and it's full of photographs and maps of all the places you love and live around. And it's based on work by many past and current members of the Nearshore Habitat Program. And we also want to thank the Squaxin Tribe because they've welcomed us to one of our main study sites that you'll hear about a lot in this presentation off Squaxin Island. So what's kelp's ecological role? Its most basic role is photosynthesis, primary production, which fuels the food web. Kelp beds have some of the highest growth rates in the world and biomass. And kelp also modifies the physical and chemical environment within the bed. And so it's distinct from its surrounding conditions, creating a distinct habitat for the animals that use it. Kelp beds provide three-dimensional habitat to a wide range of invertebrates, to fish like forage fish, salmon, and rockfish. And they also support the animals that rely on the lower food web, like birds and whales. This talk, oops, sorry, here we go. Slide problems. This talk explores two questions related to kelp in South Sound. What kelp species occur in South Puget Sound, and how has distribution changed over the long term, 100 years, or over the short term, 5? So we explored these questions by finding all the data sources we could and synthesizing them that note kelp in South Puget Sound. And the earliest are from the 1870s, so there's almost a 150-year time span. It's a diverse collection, and the historical documents are truly wonderful. I don't have time to talk about them, so I'll just mention one. The topographic sheets, completed around 1873 to 1880. You'll see an example down there. That's a kelp bed, that wavy symbol off Squaxin Island. These amazing maps were created in the field over long hours of surveying in the field with a tool called a plane table. There's a picture of it there. More recently, the surveys are by DNR by boat, the most recent surveys. And we either work in a small motorboat, often standing in the bow so we can see through the water to see what's submerged. We also do a lot of work from kayak because that gives us non-destructive access to the shallows. So let's get to our first question. What kelp species occur in South Puget Sound? A corollary for you is, what is this algae? Is it kelp? Yes. It's sugar kelp or split kelp, which is on the upper right-hand side here. And the taxonomists will warn you that you cannot differentiate those two species with a microscope, although many of us try. You need a microscope, go to the lab. So in total, we have 9 species of kelp that are recorded in South Puget Sound, which is quite a diverse kelp community for a place that doesn't pride itself on being a kelp community. Here they are here. And the most iconic one, the one you all probably know, is in the center here, bull kelp. Virtually all of the historical records concern bull kelp. Only a handful address the other species. And so the rest of my talk is really going to zero in on bull kelp. Why is bull kelp the most talked about? 2 really simple reasons. It floats on the surface, so you can see it. And it's used as a navigation aid on charts. And so often on charts, you'll see a kelp bed. And you know that wavy symbol means stay away from this area, it's shallow, it's rocky. So, okay, here's a map. that shows bull kelp observations over the last 150 years. And you'll see, just for knowing where you are, there's Point Defiance in the Narrows. Here's Olympia down here. And we're over here at the South Sound Science Symposium. This map shows kelp observations as a heat map. So yellow are areas where less than a third of the observations over the last 150 years found kelp present. So they're places where you're likely to find kelp, but not very often. It ramps up to the red places, like our favorite spot on Squaxin Island. The deep red areas are places where kelp was found most or even all of the observations over these many years. So some of you may be looking at the, oh, and by the way, that was about 20% of the shoreline. And you can see that the kelp observations are centered around these higher current, slightly saucer cup substrate areas. The heads of the bays don't have a single bull kelp observation, which makes sense, right? Because those are protected, sandy, and muddy areas. So some of you might be looking at this map and saying, wait a minute, I've never seen bull kelp on Anderson Island or McNeil Island or Ketron Island or at Johnson Point. What's up with that? Because I know most of you know South Puget Sound. Well, you're right. Distribution has changed over time. And we based one of our analyses on anecdotal reports that said that since the 1980s, there hasn't been much bull kelp south of the Tacoma Narrows. So we tested that. We don't have really high precision temporally, but we tested that and we confirmed it in the following way. We divide South Puget Sound into three regions, and we asked, how has the proportion of kelp present changed over time? And what you can see is during the first time period, before 1980, the regions were pretty similar. Median proportion of occurrence along the shorelines was about a third. In the second period, since 1980, west and central dropped to a median of zero, which is pretty low. And but there are a few outliers that are interesting to watch. This one up here, that's Squaxin Island, one of the most persistent beds. There are also five outliers in central, places where we did see bull kelp after 1980. So this map visualizes that result. And you see where bull kelp occurred post-1980 in your regular heat map. And the ice blue areas are where it was before 1980, but not after. And this may look more similar to what your mental map looks like for bull kelp in South Puget Sound now. And by the way, we've done this type of comparison in other areas. And losses of bull kelp seem to be mostly in the inner basins of Puget Sound. It seems to be more stable on the Straits and Outer Coast. So, okay, let's forget about the past for a moment and think about the present. This map, we did a survey of the entire South Puget Sound in 2013. Here's the result. We didn't plan it, but this ended up being excellent timing because we had an extreme warm water event that started in 2014 with the blob and El Nino, and kelp is sensitive to warm water. And South Puget Sound got really hot. Prior to this, in 2013, you'll see that we had four beds south of the Narrows. How did they fare? Not well. All of the four either decreased or disappeared in comparison to our most recent surveys this summer. So we'll start at Briscoe Point, which was a tiny bed, 1/10 of a hectare. It's been gone for the last 2 years. I wouldn't worry about Briscoe Point on its own. It's tiny, but as part of a larger pattern, it's concerning. Devil's Head dropped from 2 hectares to absent. Fox dropped from 1 to trace. There were 19 plants that we counted there. And one of our most persistent beds, our poster child, Squaxin Island, dropped from 9 hectares to 1/3 of its size, about 3 hectares. So total areas decreased. The other thing we're concerned about is that the condition seems poor. These are some pictures from Squaxin Island on the left in July and September. And you'll see it in comparison to some beds in the Narrows. The blades are tattered, they're small, there's physical damage. By September, there are no blades, and there are a lot of kelp crabs. I'm gonna hand this over to Max Calloway in a second. He's gonna talk a lot about plant and bed condition, so we'll get back to that. In the meantime, I'm gonna talk about possible causes, and we've got four prime suspects. First of all, I had mentioned extreme warm water temperatures. Those anomalies presumably are coming to an end. Maybe the water temperature will cool down and the beds will return. That would be great. Second stressor, As you all know, sea urchins are the classic grazers in kelp beds, and they can create kelp barrens. We have a different grazer here, I think, northern kelp crabs. These are, they are abundant in some of these beds, and they've been shown through experimental feeding trials to prefer bull kelp, other algae, and also other invertebrates. Another potential stressor, sargassum, which is in the forefront of this picture. It's an introduced alga that's known to outcompete native kelps. It grows earlier in the season and shades them out. That's the mechanism. And in this picture, I outlined the distinction between the sargassum bed and the native bull kelp bed. A lot of places we go to where we've lost bull kelp, we find dense sargassum. And we also often see it shallower. Last and most complex is water quality, probably most important. Degradation to water quality can lead to low light and sedimentation, and that can also affect the competitive advantage that kelp has, and it ends up getting beaten out by algal turfs and other species. The microscopic life stages are most sensitive, and these are baby pictures for you. These are gametophytes. This is a young sporophyte. This is the plant that grows up to the plant you know. So water quality degradation has probably, the type of stressors probably changed a lot over the last 150 years. 100 years ago, it was probably logging. These days, it's probably human development. So when I show people these slides, they all often ask, like, what are we going to do about this? And so I just wanted to quickly summarize some of the ideas and also some of the challenges that we'd have to face to get to those ideas. So idea number one, remove stressors, starting with getting rid of the kelp crabs and their sargassum. Two challenges to face. We need to make sure by testing that removal actually improves bull kelp abundance and condition. And we also would need to develop an effective control measure method that doesn't harm the bed. Second, restore the beds with kelp transplants. This is one of the trickiest options for me because generally speaking, bull kelp restoration has had very low success rates. And so that would be the first hurdle. And the second hurdle is that Squaxin Island in South Puget Sound has this really interesting genetic issue. We have really low genetic diversity in our kelp, in our bull kelp plants. That could lead to two different ramifications. One, if we add new genetic stock, it could increase fitness. That would be a good thing. The second is if we have local adaptations here that allow the kelp to survive, introducing new stock could dilute local adaptation and harm the plants. So those are the things, those are the challenges thinking about restoration. And finally, evaluate plant condition and stressors. This is the route we're taking as aggressively as we can now. And what we hope to get out of that is enhanced understanding to target all of these future actions. So in quick summary, South Puget Sound has a diverse kelp community. Most is known about bull kelp. It's declined. And the type of research areas we're thinking about now are plant condition, stressors, and other possible actions. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Max Calloway, who's going to talk about plant condition and stressors a bit more. Max?
Thanks, Helen, for that great overview on bull kelp in the South Puget Sound, and just a little bit of what we've been seeing in the trends and distributions. And I'm going to kind of pick it up from her and talk more about how we were assessing plant condition and what we were seeing as far as plant condition response to some key interacting stressors. So we're going to start off by talking a little bit about why we picked our sites, go into some of the details and data from what we saw as far as plant condition over the summer, and then move on to talk about three of a bunch of stressors that we were monitoring. Unfortunately, we only have time to talk about temperature, grazing, and available substrate, which I believe show a really interesting trend at these beds. And then we're going to finish up with a discussion of a little bit of what the next steps in this analysis are and some takeaway messages. So as Helen was pointing out, there aren't that many existing kelp beds in the South Puget Sound. Initially, we had planned to study three sites intensively, those being Tuxhill Point, the X, where Devil's Head is, Day Island, and we ended up using Salmon Beach as the third site because, unfortunately, as Helen mentioned, the Devil's Head bed never showed up. there was a surface canopy mapped in 2017. That surface canopy did not show up this year. In June, I did a quick snorkel survey just to see if there were any plants maybe submerged. I counted about a half a dozen. None of them were reaching the surface. I dove the site in August to try to do a more detailed survey, and all of the plants were gone by that point. All of these plants, interestingly enough, were tenuously kind of tangled in understory kelp species. Usually kelp is anchored pretty well to hard substrates. These were kind of just caught in other algal mats, which we can talk a little bit about in a second. So key to this was trying to figure out how we were going to determine plant condition. We ended up using 36 meter squared transects that were evenly distributed in the known area of the beds from last year. In those, at those sampling points, we were counting the density of plants, the density of kelp crabs, and we were taking individual plants, counting the number of blades, counting the number of reproductive blades, measuring the blades, and assessing some damage. And we were seeing some pretty clear trends. So here is plant density over the three beds that we ended up sampling. So, as I said earlier, Salmon Beach was added as kind of a last minute thing once we realized Devil's Head wasn't going to show up, so that we only have two data points for that. And there's no data for Squaxin Island in September because, as you will see, these plants were in really rough shape by the end of August, and so we didn't sample again in September. But you can see clear trends where, you know, this seems to just be the trajectory of these kelp beds. Bull kelp is an annual. They start off at high densities. By the time you get to September, you have lower densities. What is interesting is just how low the density was at Squaxin Island. We were also measuring blades, and we were seeing a large variety in the field there. You can see Helen wrestling with some massive blades up in Port Townsend. And again, similar trends to plant density. Except in this case, when you look at Squaxin Island between July and August, that is a drop from about an average of 2 meters blade length to zero. None of the plants sampled in August had any blades left on them. And the important thing about blade length is that it seems to be correlated with the amount of reproductive sori on the blades. The sori are these dark chocolate patches that you can see in the upper left of this picture, and that's where all of the reproductive material of these plants are produced. And so with lowering of kelp blade length, we're also maybe seeing an impact to reproductive ability. And all of this kind of comes back down to damage. So we were using a subjective damage scale, zero being no damage, three being high damage. You can see some examples there. And similar, Squaxin Island is the only site where we consistently had plants of a damage class of three. Day Island being somewhat intermediate as far as the amount of damage on the plants, and Salmon Beach having fairly healthy looking plants throughout the entirety of the season. So the other thing we were curious about is what explains these trends. We only have time to discuss a few, as I said before. So we were looking right now at substrate availability, temperature, and grazing pressure. And the literature is rife with examples of all of these stressors interacting synergistically, where when you get both of these things or some of these things interacting, you have bigger impacts than you would necessarily expect from just the individual stressors. In the winter, we were looking at space availability, substrate availability. We were using this drop camera that you can see my friend John sitting in front of at the Tacoma Narrows. And kelp requires hard substrates. It doesn't form roots like eelgrass. It just kind of sticks onto things. And all kelp species compete fiercely for that substrate come spring. We saw, again, some pretty interesting trends. So at Squaxin Island, we were seeing some intermediate substrate availability, a fair number of fine kind of siltier patches, sandy patches with cobble and pebble mixed in. Day Island, it's a little bit difficult to see from the picture, but that's all clean, available pebble and cobble. And Devil's Head, which had almost no substrate. It was all soft substrates. The other big one that Helen mentioned is temperature. So kelp, all kelp are cold water species, and warm temperatures stress all life stages. The thresholds for different life stages, from the adult plant to the microscopic spores and gametophytes, are different, but they are generally within the same range. Temperature, unless you hit really high temperatures, isn't going to directly give you any measurable impact to the plants, but at lower high temperatures, you know, kind of just in the low end of that stress range, you see a decrease in resilience to other stressors. In California, high temperatures are also kind of a correl. It's used hand in hand with low nutrients. They have an upwelling regime. High temperatures block those nutrients. We are waiting on some water nutrient results from the UW to see if we have similar trends here in the South Puget Sound. And for bull kelp specifically, the stress range is between 15 to 20 degrees Celsius with a really high mortality and rapid mortality when you get up to 18, 20 degrees Celsius. So what were we seeing? Squaxin Island, if you look at July, is above 16 degrees Celsius, and it jumps pretty quickly from June to July. By August, all sites except for Salmon Beach have temperatures above 14 degrees Celsius, with Devil's Head approaching that 15 degrees Celsius mark. And so we were seeing this clear gradient in not only plant condition, but then also temperatures at these sites. And temperature does appear to have a negative relationship with blade length. So again, some impacts to reproductive ability. As Helen also mentioned, kelp crabs and grazers are something that's very much on our radar as far as a potential stressor for these sites. We were seeing in the field kind of it was almost like a horror movie where you'd have these plants that were looking really just ragged and they were covered in these kelp crabs, which look kind of like aliens. And similar trends with Squaxin Island having larger crab densities and also having the lowest plant density. So you can see that, you know, that grazer impact is going to be felt much harder at a site that starts off the season and has a lower average plant density throughout the summer than at, say, a site like Salmon Beach, where they had almost no kelp crabs and high density of plants. As Helen mentioned in the literature, we know that these things do like to eat bull kelp and other kelp. We believe that they are causing physical damage by using the plants as substrate. This is what it looks like late summer at Squaxin Island. You can see girdling on the stipe and all sorts of, it just looks awful. And again, Squaxin Island has the highest kelp crab densities. And if you look at just the damage class rankings that we were giving to all the plants, Squaxin Island is the only one that has damage ratings of 3. And as a proportion of overall observations of damage class at Squaxin Island, it's more than half of those observations. We're still waiting on some data. Like I said, we have water nutrient data that's coming in from the UW, and we're in the process of processing tissue samples for carbon nitrogen analysis to try to fill in another really important piece of this story, which is nutrient availability. Some takeaways, plant condition and bed condition at Squaxin is the lowest that we saw, although it is doggedly persistent. It is kind of amazing that Devil's Head winked out this year, and we documented that, and yet Squaxin Island with significantly higher temperatures, more stressors, is still holding on, so it's a pretty resilient bed. Devil's Head, lack of substrate combined with high temperatures likely is stressing that bed and contributing to its decline. And it seems as though the highest temperatures coincide with the highest damage rating and highest kelp crab numbers. In Squaxin Island, we were seeing that in July, and we were seeing a similar trend, not as severe, and a month later at Day Island, which gives us a little bit concern that this is maybe the overall trend in South Puget Sound and that it's just kind of moving its way north. Other stressors and interactions between them obviously play a role, and this is not the end of the story at all. This is kind of a first step towards figuring out what we should be focusing our efforts, our monitoring and conservation efforts on into the future. Thanks.
All right, questions for Helen and Max? Move to the mic, please, if you have a question. Over here.
Just curious, what eats kelp crabs, and do they taste good to humans?
Great question, Mindy. I know that Betty Bookheim's been hoping that we can start a kelp crab fishery that's centered at Squaxin Island. So, you know, I've been asking Greg Jensen and other people a lot of those questions, and here's an interesting one. Rockfish eat crabs, probably not the adult crabs, but they definitely, crabs are a big part of, juvenile crabs are a big part of rockfish diets. And so what we may have, what immediately you start asking yourself is what changes have there been to the structure, the biological community structures of these beds that might lead to the type of change we're seeing in the kelp crabs. We've been looking for other information on what eats kelp crabs. I just found a report from the San Juans. I was hoping that river otters might eat a lot of kelp crabs. I guess they prefer the gracilis rather than the producta. So not this one. But yeah, so it does really point to, though, perhaps a change in the biotic community as a whole and the predators on the grazers.
Hi, do you think if value or increasing available larger substrates would be a viable restoration option for bull kelp?
So you're going to get two answers here. The first is from DNR. We're very conservative about adding substrate to an environment because we believe it changes it from its natural habitat. So we would be very careful about taking that approach. The question here that's really interesting about substrate is, has the substrate changed in South Puget Sound? And what would have led to those type of substrate changes? But now you're going to get a second answer.
From the Restoration Fund side of things, it is something that we are thinking about. I think that we are have similar concerns as DNR as far as what is that ecological impact. We are planning some bull kelp enhancement where we will be using kind of weighted concrete blocks to kind of wrap with inoculate line of seed stock to get those adult plants in the water to see if we can restart a bed. And substrate, it's an interesting one. I echo Helen. I think we're all curious about how that has changed and at what scale it's changed and what the impact is.
Hello. My question is, did you look for, and if you did you see an increase in urchins in South Sound? And the reason I'm asking that is this is sort of coincident with the sea star die-off that's happened since 2013, and that sea star die-off has, at least anecdotally in other places, released the predation pressure on urchins, and they have increased in abundance.
That's an absolutely great question, and it's one of the things that we're thinking about a lot. So in some areas, the disappearance of sea stars have led to the increases of sea urchins. One of the things that really, and we all know that urchins are a major stressor on kelp beds as grazers in many locations. They are the main, you know, if you go to California, the main discussion is urchin control. What's interesting to us is we do a lot of underwater videography towing around Puget Sound as part of our program, in many projects for the South Puget Sound, or the Nearshore Habitat Program. And we very rarely see what we would call an urchin barren. And we very rarely see, if we do find something that's an urchin barren, that we would call that, it's very spatially limited to small patches. And so one of the things that we really think about is why do urchins play such a different role here? And so as of right now, we don't see, I can remember a couple of rocks where I've seen a lot of urchins, and we have a couple of sites. We're actually counting urchins now as part of a King County-wide program that we're doing. So we're enumerating them per site, and we see them in small aggregations, but we never see the type of thing that you see that are so common in other areas where you have denuded areas caused by urchin grazing.
All right. My question is about the West Central and East Sound that you talked about in the very beginning. So you said there were decreases in bull kelp in West and Central, but not in East. But then we never went back to the East to talk about, well, what's different in the East section, and could that be a control area?
That's a great question. I can go back to the map. So the east section is up in the Narrows where Day Island and Salmon Beach are. So Day Island was the site that had sort of intermediate densities of crabs and plants and similar trends to Squaxin Island, but not as severe or as dramatic. Salmon Beach is farther north. It's a little bit hard to see on the map, but it's north of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge up by Point Defiance. And if you look at that temperature graph again, those temperature differences, especially in the summer, are pretty dramatic between Salmon Beach and Squaxin Island, which are pink and purple at the top and bottom of this graph. Salmon Beach, being the healthiest bed that we had, also has a plethora of really nice aggregated hard substrates, so big boulders and just a lot more space. And interestingly enough, it's the only site, just anecdotally, that we actually saw any urchins at, but they didn't appear to be really doing much.
I agree. I think that the eastern area is a clue. It's really well mixed. It has it's really well mixed waters. It has strong currents, and it demonstrates to us that bull kelp can thrive in South Puget Sound. So you got it.
One last question over here.
I also had a question about crabs and if there's any historic comparable data around the crab density and abundance, and whether we can see whether there are more kelp crabs than there were in the past.
The crab question is interesting. I know Helen is now obsessed with kelp crabs. She bought a bunch of nets this summer. I don't know of any survey data for South Puget Sound, but if you talk to, the amount of traditional knowledge that I hear, that, you know, we all hear at docks and different places, I feel like every single time I talk to anybody at a public dock, they always tell me, like, oh, you're looking at kelp, there's less of it. And then I always go, oh, yeah, you've seen less? What do you think it is? And they're like, it's the crabs, more crabs. And it's pretty much every single time I ask somebody. So I think that it's an interesting question. The fishery aspect of it is really interesting to us, too, of just what were there historic controls on their populations that we've changed. But it's kind of wide open right now, as far as, from my opinion, and Helen's nodding in agreement.
Thank you.